This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here. And I want to thank the ADL for their terrific guest suggestions, such as my guest today, Carolyn Yeager, who is a writer and researcher specializing in World War II and Holocaust revisionism. She's the author of a 48-page booklet titled Auschwitz, The Underground Guided Tour, What the Tour Guides Don't Tell You at Auschwitz-Birkenau. You can also read her work, Exposing the False Testimony of the World's Most Famous Holocaust Survivor, Elie Wiesel, Wiesel the Weasel. If you visit carolynyeager.com, you'll find her radio program and writings. I was inspired to do this program after iTunes censored and removed Red Ice Radio, most likely for the Dennis Weiss interview. He's the creator of the documentary called Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. You can post videos of any filth and degenerate thing you can think of, but questioning any aspect of World War II history is off limits. Isn't it obvious, ladies and gentlemen, that indeed there's an ongoing cover-up going on when you can be jailed for questioning the Holocaust? What other event can you go to jail for questioning? The Holocaust should be a historical event, although it's become a religion. But if it's history, it's subject to the same kind of research and scrutiny as other past events. And it must be subjected to critical investigation, especially by Germans who have every right to investigate since they're still paying reparations to Israel. Have you heard of any other Holocaust where reparations of this scale were involved? Israel is milking Germany. And generations of innocent children are told that they're to take collective responsibility for the Holocaust. Soviets destroyed my family in Russia. Where's my reparations? Where's the collective guilt coming from communists? Well, here are the claims being made by Holocaust revisionists, so it's loud and clear. There was no plan to murder all Jews. The Jews were not murdered systematically. Gas chambers for mass murder did not exist. 6 million Jews did not die in the Holocaust. Revisionists are not denying the following: that Jews were persecuted, that Jews were deprived of civil rights, that Jews were deported, that Jews were herded into ghettos. They don't deny the existence of concentration camps or that Jews were put to forced labor. They don't deny the existence of crematoria in concentration camps. In fact, the capacity of the crematories were barely sufficient to cremate the bodies. They do not deny that Jews died from a great number of reasons: epidemics, malnutrition, disease. They don't deny that others were also persecuted, such as gypsies and political dissenters. They do not claim that Jews deserved it, or that we shouldn't remember victims or show compassion to them. War is not pretty, folks, but the Allies weren't angels either. In fact, if you take the time to watch the censored 6-hour documentary called The Greatest Story Never Told, you'll learn of the vicious, ugly atrocities the Allies committed upon innocent German women, children, and soldiers during and even after the war. If you can understand how American elite today meddle in other countries, creating problems, then don't be so quick to say that they were the innocent party during the Nazi era. All right, let's bring on Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, thank you, and I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, for listeners who don't know all about your terrific articles and radio programs, tell us about your background and how you came to one of your specialties, which is Holocaust revisionism.
Wow. Well, my background is in art. I haven't talked about myself and my background for such a long time. I should have boned up on it a little bit, but I don't really want to spend a lot of time going into that. But I had I was born and grew up in the Middle West in a German-American family, and very normal and nice and pleasant and happy. And I was always interested in art, and so I pursued that in school. And then I pursued that after school in various ways. I was worked in commercial art most of the time. I was really interested in fashion illustration. But I majored in school in painting, but I thought, well, I'll teach. But then I didn't want to teach, and I didn't want to continue after I got my Bachelor of Fine Arts. I didn't want to continue after that to go on to get a master's. So I started working in commercial art, and then I then I got back to painting later on. However, in 2004, I had been living back here in the United States again, and permanently, and I kind of lost my interest in a lot of things I had been doing, and there was the political campaign of George Bush against John Kerry that year, and I was involved with the Democrats because I hated George Bush so much, and it was towards the end of that campaign, like in maybe October or something, that I was introduced to a man who talking about the 9/11 fraud, and he had some videos and so on, and I found him interesting. No one else did, but I did, and I eventually looked at his videos, and then I got going in revisionist materials, and I guess you'd say the truth movement in the beginning, and I had gotten onto the using the internet. I hadn't used the internet that much earlier. I kind of wanted to stay away from it. Mm-hmm. Foolish now, I can't get away from it now. I can't leave it alone. So, but that got me going, and I went through all the stages that everybody goes through, and eventually found myself most interested in Holocaust revisionism and National Socialism. And I thought, I really like the people who are talking about this better than the people who are against it. And so I just kept going with it. And I really felt, when I think at the time, how funny it is. I really was, I wasn't fearful at all, because there was nothing to be afraid of. But I was very hesitant, like, can I believe such a thing, mm-hmm. Or can I continue to... What if I, can I think this way? Is it okay to think this way? And that was, and then I made this big breakthrough one day that I recall very well, when I just knew. It was like a big epiphany. I had already come a long way, but I then just, everything dropped, and I knew Adolf Hitler, I'm going to talk about Adolf Hitler now, was a great man. And all of the things that I had been feeling and looking into were true, and everything else was lies, and it was just like I've had this great sense of joy, and it was because I found, I would say, the truth for me, and it's been the truth for me ever since then.
It's quite a liberating process, especially for you, probably, with your German heritage, going through the deprogramming of the anti-German lies, correct?
Yes, I mean, that played a big part in it, and that plays a big part in it today. My identity, I wasn't thinking I was searching for my identity, but that's actually what I did find. So
now, if we back up a bit, being of German heritage yourself, what were you taught to believe about the Germans and the Nazis in World War II?
Well, see, I go back quite a ways. I'm probably older than most of your guests, and certainly older than those two lovely women who you had on in your last program, I believe. I really enjoyed listening to them. So when I was growing up, nothing was said about any of that. And I grew up in a town that had a lot of German people in it. It wasn't, you wouldn't call it a German town at all. The majority would have been English, I guess, whatever, Scottish and so on. But there was a large German community. It wasn't all the different types of German communities there. And there was nothing against Germans. And I was, I knew enough about Germany to know that it was a country with a great cultural history and past. Even when I was young, I knew that. I felt proud to be I felt very secure in being German. And my parents, well, once in a while I asked some questions, because I did pick things up mostly after I got into junior high and high school, just in the news. I remember one day looking at a magazine, and there was this article. I was just in my home. There was an article about Hitler and how he had mesmerized the German people. And it was one of those pictures of him, you know, where he's giving a speech and his mouth wide open and so on. I think that's what it was. And there are pictures of the people listening and being looking like they were just, oh, and I thought, of course, I thought he was an ugly person. I didn't like his looks. I couldn't imagine anybody having a mustache like that. And anybody being attracted to him. And I just thought to myself, I mean, I believed it, what they were saying. And I thought, why did the German people fall for him like that? Why did they believe in him? And I couldn't understand. And I read the article. It says because he had used these mesmerizing tactics, you know, that he had some kind of hypnotic power. And then it had probably some criticisms of the German people and the way they were so susceptible to this. And who knows what it all said. But I forgot about it. But at the time, I was bothered by it, and I really wanted to understand. And a couple times I asked my mother, you know, why did that happen in Germany? And she said, she told me, well, the Germans got too arrogant, or what was the word she used, too carried away with themselves. But nobody ever apologized about it. I did hear stories. I did know that my grandfather was a supporter of Hitler. He was here in the United States, but he was for Hitler, and he and my father used to have arguments, you know, friendly kind of family, what they called them arguments, about that. And I remember them doing that. And my father said Hitler was bad for Germany, and my grandfather said Hitler was good for Germany. But after the after Pearl Harbor and after the, you know, we got into war with Germany, he stopped doing that. And he had a business too, you know, and he supposedly, he says, well, maybe Hitler wasn't so good after all, but I imagine he probably still liked him. He just couldn't really stand up for him anymore, what with all the horrible stories coming out and so on.
Have you lost friends because of your interest in Holocaust revisionism?
I would, but I don't talk to people too much about it, and I don't have the kind of friends that I did, you know, since this time. I spend most of my time on online, and I meet people there, and so I have all these friends online, and I don't keep up. I had a couple of friends, who learned about me, and she they were very liberal. In fact, she was in the Democratic Party when I was campaigning with the Democrats, and we got to be good friends, and she was she just thought, oh well, you know. But eventually it did break up our friendship, because I couldn't stop bringing up the Jews, and she just hated for me to ever bring up the Jews. But every time we'd get into it, she was very political too, so we'd start discussing politics, one thing or another, and I finally would have to say, well, you know, it's the Jews doing this, whatever. I could not bring I couldn't keep them out of it. And she'd say, oh, not the Jews again. Oh, my God, you know. And actually, it got to be kind of unpleasant, and I just stopped seeing her. So, yeah, you know, it's a huge divide.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that people, I mean, even in the truther scene or alternative research, it's incredible watching the reactions from these so-called alt researchers who immediately show their truth-seeking threshold wall and won't even give a second to the subject, and immediately they side with the mainstream view against Nazi Germany, even though they know that history is written by the victor. So it's pretty amazing for me to see, even in the alt scene, how people take a stance against Germany.
Well, it is for me too, and I've stopped trying to understand it, because it's just a matter of people don't feel that there's any benefit they could get. If they don't have any connection, say like I did, you know, where I really wanted to know, and I felt a familiarity somehow with everything I learned about Germany during World War II. But if they don't have that, and there's nothing to benefit them at all from opening up to it or thinking differently about it. That's the only thing I can say is why they don't.
And for me, I'd say it matters because truth matters. So we should be digging into these things, especially if we are truth seekers or if we're journalists. We need to dig deeper. We need to find out and pull out the truth. But why do you think historical revisionism is important and necessary? Because there's a lot of it going around right now.
Well, what you just said, because there are always people who want the truth. And after World War I, it was clear that a lot was done that was wrong to Germany, and there were people who were called revisionists, like Harry Elmer Barnes, just for one. I can't think of all their names, but who started writing, questioning things and writing different versions and looking into the history and bringing out information that was being suppressed and so on. And they were not welcome in the academic, accepted circles, but they weren't as dismissed. They were still listened to, and people would discuss back and forth with them and so on. They had a certain amount of respect at that time. But after World War II, that was a different story. It was just a different kind of a slapdown that nobody was allowed to have a different version of history or a different point of view. So, people respond to revisionism very well. A lot of people, the ones that listen to it, I think the others don't want to hear it for the most part. So they just don't want to get into it, and they don't find it interesting. People want to live their life. They don't want to be troubled with having to take a stand on something unpopular. But you asked me, I guess, why it's important. Mm-hmm. Well, the only reason I can ever come up with, same as you, is because we want to know the truth. But people will say, it is true. I think that people are not very interested in truth, really. Most people. Mm-hmm. Truth is something that people will look for that fits in with what they want to believe. And if it doesn't fit in, then they'll deny it. So just plain truth seeking. I mean, I don't know how much we are. I think a lot of it, we get certain political ideas, and I use that word pretty broadly. We feel sympathetic along certain lines, and then we're more open to that as truth. And if you're sympathetic along other lines, and there's so many leftists in the world who are, for some reason, are convinced of that, then they're just not going to want to. They're not going to want to hear things that oppose that, even if it can be proved that it's the truth.
I'd say the Holocaust is a really important one to focus on too, because it's the moral cornerstone, I'd say, of the entire, this post-war order. They stand on this cornerstone of the Holocaust, and they put their whole version of history depends on this being real. So that's why they're imprisoning people who are challenging it, even presenting, scientific accuracy surrounding Holocaust claims. So it's amazing that it's not illegal in U.S. yet, considering our Zionist-occupied government. And I know recently Putin made it illegal to question any aspect of the Holocaust. Do you think that may be coming here to the States?
Well, I hope not. And I don't even like to say what you just said, which so many people do. Well, it's amazing. It won't be long before we won't be able to talk about it here. I think that's a big mistake to ever say that. We should just say, of course, we have free speech here, and because it gets people kind of ready for things.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
They
yeah.
say, oh, well, we're so lucky, we still can talk about it, but it won't be long. And then we're sort of prepared to let it go. We cannot let it go. My God, that's kind of like the Dark Ages then, and I'm very disturbed about Putin doing what he did. Of course, he was, Russia had its own point of view on the whole history, but he didn't have, it wasn't so against the law, and there are some revisionists living in Russia who have been working there, and I don't know if this will make it more difficult for them. It's difficult enough already. So it's not a good thing that that he's gone ahead and passed these laws. And I can't really figure out, I know he's, what he's doing in the world today, but I can't figure out if that fits into what his aims and agenda are today, or if it's just something separate that they thought they should do to make sure that they can have that they can keep people from practicing revisionism in Germany. But that's a sign that it's getting worse and stronger, which is, I guess, what you were getting at. That it's getting worse instead of better.
That's why we need more people to wake up to the subject and more people to talk about it. So for those who are new to the subject, what does Holocaust revisionism claim? Because a lot of people think these things that are completely untrue. So let's talk about the points that it does claim.
Well, it's always been said that the three major points of Holocaust, that the Holocaust depends on, are the 6 million number, the intention of the Germans to exterminate all these Jews, as many as they could, or eventually all, or whatever, that they had a plan, so that would be called the plan. And then the third thing was, what was the third thing? That it was done in gas chambers. Yeah, and so, in a sense, without the gas chambers, there's not really a Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
Without the 6 million, there's not, and without there being a plan, there's not. Although I don't now, you might have noticed on my website that I have a block there that you can click on and go to a site called January27.org, and that's a site that I am maintaining. Since it went up last January, and it's basically only gets real pertinent around January. But I went there real quick to make sure I had those three items right. But there's a number of things that have kind of these are things to question about it. But these three things, and of course. Nobody would really, so many people now say, well, I don't know about the 6 million. So, but it was a lot, but it might not have been 6 million. What if it's 4 million? And then people like to say, well, if there was only 1 million, or if there's only 100 people that were killed like that, it's still a Holocaust.
I've heard that. Yep.
Doesn't make sense.
Yep.
And of course, the plan has been written about because they've never found any evidence of one. So then they make up this thing called code words and so on that they really meant this, even though they didn't say it. And then, of course, the gas chambers are in the process of being debunked, and they have been. But new people come along, or some people decide to change their mind. Like David Irving, say, well, there were some gassings, but not at Auschwitz. But this website, January 27. If anybody is interested in the basics of the Holocaust, I would really recommend it because it's based on only Auschwitz-Birkenau, and because that is what the January 27 commemoration is based on, because that was the date of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau, the date they've given it in what they call the liberation of it. It really was never truly liberated, but it's very basic, because at one time the whole Holocaust was about Auschwitz, what happened at Auschwitz-Birkenau, mm-hmm. and they had 4 million people gassed there, which has come down now. Now they claim 1.1 million, but when that goes, this whole site is about what really happened, what didn't happen, what's said, and so on. I think it's very good. If you would read the whole thing, you could hardly believe in it anymore. And when Auschwitz goes, the whole thing goes. But because of that, the attention has been moved to particularly those camps in the east. Belzec, Sobibor, and and Treblinka. And Treblinka's been in the news a lot lately, mm-hmm. and a lot of people are working on that because they decided, well, there are more Jews killed in gas chambers than those camps, and a couple others around there.
Eric Hunt did a documentary.
Yes, mm-hmm. Eric Hunt, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's working on another one now. He has three major documentaries out, major what you'd call films, you know, full-length films now. But I still think his first one is the best. It was really quite a stunner and eye-opener because he brought in a lot of things. And that was one called the Big Lie of the, what's this?
Spielberg.
Spielberg, yeah. Yes, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Spielberg interviews and so on. The Spielberg film about something about Die in it, and he made a play on that title for his title. It's very, 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 very good. But his others are good too. But I think that's the best one. It's hard sometimes to beat the first thing
yeah,
you do.
Yeah, it's just true. Well, here's the thing. When we say Holocaust people, what they see in their mind is just piles of bodies in concentration camps. But they died from typhus. And there's a tremendous difference between being victims of raging epidemics and victims of this planned industrial mass murder and chemical slaughterhouses made for homicide. You know, so that's the big point we need to stress here.
Well, I think you're onto something there. And Fritz Berg would be happy to talk to you, I'm sure. I don't know whether I should be promoting that, but he's just recently came out again. This is something he said before, that the key to a Holocaust, killing the Holocaust, if you might say, is typhus, is to emphasize the typhus. That he's researched it quite a bit, and he has a lot to say about how those people in Eastern Europe were just big carriers of typhus, and when they got moved and when they were all put together, and he will talk about how they hated to bathe and they hated to change their clothes, and they saw all that as a punishment for them when they were detained, and then they were forced to take showers
and they shaved their head because of the
so,
lice,
and then they shaved and so on, yeah. And that was all. That all really fueled the idea that they were being persecuted, and then they turned that into, well, we went into these shower rooms and people were killed with gas, and it just all came from there. You know, it came from the shower rooms that they turned into gas chambers in their minds, and they had all these rumors going around in the camps, and then there were the Polish resistance that was because the camps were in Poland, and the Polish resistance was very active, and they really should have. They were in a sense, the Germans in a sense were too nice to the Poles. They had all these Poles working in these places, and they managed to do all kinds of secret underground work and send radio messages and so on, and they started all those big lies about gas chambers and so on. So what you were saying earlier really fits in here about what people believe, because the fact that people took hold of these stories, and of course the governments that were against Germany loved them, and so they played them up and the media played them up, and it became such a solid thing that afterwards you can't get rid of it. In the past wars, you know, there's always war propaganda,
mm-hmm.
and usually afterwards it takes a while and it's a lot of work, but that's what these revisionists are doing. They're you know, exposing these things as propaganda, and eventually people would get back on a more normal stance about it, but not this time, not after World War II. I do believe that the powers, those joint powers, were absolutely determined, and the Jewish power too, which was a separate power that worked with them and within them and so on, was absolutely determined to never let Germany be rehabilitated, mm-hmm. from this.
Yeah.
Keep it, and that's what they've still been able to do.
What do you think their hatred comes from, the Allies, the Soviets in America at the time, England? Why did they hate Germany so much?
Well, there's been a lot of work done on the competitive spirit that went back to the 1870s, and probably could take it back a little bit before, but basically around then, when Germany was a younger country as a united country. It had been separate, you know, German states under different kinds of rulers that all considered themselves German, but now Bismarck managed to, and actually Frederick the Great before him, but he managed to unite all these into one German Prussian federal state. It wasn't the entire thing yet, but it was a big united Germany. And Germans are very industrious and hardworking people, very capable. And so once they, you know, they started going into manufacturing and so on in a way that was competition for Britain. And the French were always jealous of and competitive with Germany because they were next door neighbors. And then the United States, which might be a surprise to Americans, and it certainly was for me, and it took quite a while for it to sink in for me to think of the United States as being such a power hungry, oh, maybe I shouldn't use it, but
that's
ambitious,
okay.
Ambitious kind of a people that really wanted to be number one, and even over Britain. And so, and then Russia, the same thing, was a big power. And so everybody saw Germany as taking up and not wanting to let Germany have its get into a major power the way it wanted to. And Germany did want to be a major power because it felt like it was, you know. It felt like it was just as good as the others and just as strong and wanted to show what it could be, all that it could be. So it's just strange that because these countries were all around Germany, and they could kind of unite and say, okay, we'll defeat Germany. And they did that, whether they were fully conscious all the time or had some big plan together, or they just kind of worked out between, you know, sometimes it was France and Russia, sometimes it was France and Britain, and of course it was a lot, was Britain and the United States. And they were, they all thought that it was Germany that they wanted to get rid of. And when, that's what I think. I think it's purely economic and how much you can be the strongest one, the strongest guy on the block. And this is something that happened between white people, see?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
This is what we did. And to think that I'm very skeptical now, and I wasn't always, but I have in the last year become more skeptical of uniting white people on a worldwide scale like this in some way that we could all work together for our common interests. Because our history doesn't show, and we don't show it now either, that we can really work together the way it would be necessary to do so. That's not our nature, you know. Our nature is being so individualistic, and we're separated in so many ways that while we can think, you know, oh, we'd like to do this, we know it would be good, but I don't see that we could do it. So I think we have to take a different approach.
Well, I don't think there's any uniting with these leftist whites, but I think that the other ones that aren't leftists will have a strong possibility of uniting because we're now becoming minorities in our lands and we have a same common enemy, if you will. So I do see a uniting happening that will take place. And who knows, maybe we'll go find and make our own country somewhere else. We'll claim Greenland.
Well, I think you have to have a base. I think you have to have a geographical base. When we have all these bases all around, that's what makes it harder to actually say, well, we're all one, which you almost have to do, because who's going to lead? Somebody's got to lead things.
Yeah.
I do believe that nothing gets done unless you have a leader.
Yep.
And we don't. And that's why I think we have to have separate separate parts of ourselves with leaders, and we can't even find leaders for these. And of course, they make it very difficult, because as soon as you get a strong leader, they make sure that something happens to them. So we're up against tremendous power, tremendously and highly organized power today. That I continually become more respectful of, you might say, because I'm realizing that it's not something that because they don't intend to let go.
No, they don't. Well, that's why and I think it's another important reason to expose the reality concerning the Nazis, because the left loves to use that as their number one weapon to morally justify the destruction of any Europeans who stand up for their culture, nation, and for their folk. Right away, they scream Nazi like it's a bad thing, right?
Oh, I'm 100% with you there. 100%. And that I think, is the message that has to go out. That's basically my message. But there are people who say, well, we don't want to. There is the faction that's very pro-white that says, well, but we don't want to talk about Nazis because, you know, that's a dead end. That we'll never get over that. You know, that we'll never get over the animosity or the distrust of that whole regime. And we fought them in the war. And how can we now, you know, be standing up for them? So we should just drop that. So that's one of the big debates going on, is whether to use Holocaust and National Socialism to stand up for it, or whether to say that's bad news for us and let's drop it and let's just talk about white rights and so on.
Yeah. Well, I'm not a socialist, but looking into National Socialism and thinking what's occurring to our folk today, if there was a system where like-minded folk had excellence, high culture, family, and real success and prosperity in mind, then heck yeah, I'd contribute to that system. Instead, today we're asked to be socialists for the world, which is essentially communism. The Nazis didn't have a socialist system like we'd think of it today. I think, number one, it had the folk in mind. It was about the interests of the nation and the nation only. They didn't send aid to Africa. National Socialism was business-friendly, worker-friendly, family-friendly. They paid lower taxes than we do. It was anti-usury, and people weren't sick and starving. You know, everyone was expected to contribute, and degenerate art and behavior was not promoted, but it wasn't banned like the commies today, who will put you in jail for art. I know the Nazis even banned experimenting on animals for research purposes, and of course, women were encouraged to have babies. And companies didn't outsource work to foreign countries. So what more can you tell us about the Nazi system?
Well, economically, I think I'm not an expert on that, and just offhand, but that's my understanding that they did, although a lot was asked of German people eventually, you know, a lot of sacrifice, but a lot was done for them as much as could be possible. What impresses me in what you were first saying there is the literature. I think the National Socialist literature is just fantastic. Well, I love it. It inspires me. I think I just love the way and I only read translations of it, but I like the way the Germans, and under National Socialism, they really did they had a cohesiveness about them, and they sounded the same. You know, they accepted a lot of basic premises, and that's what they taught and put forth. And there was some division, you know, amongst the higher ranks and so on, and probably always personality disputes and so on. But in the literature, it's so consistent, and particularly I like the literature for the young people. If you go over to that website, calvin.edu or whatever, where there's Bit, Rand, is his name, Randolph Bitwerks website, where he has all this German propaganda material translated from National Socialist Germany from those years, actually starting in the 20s and going all the way through 44 and so. And some of the material for school kids, particularly school girls, since you're female, you deal with these women's issues and so on. The material for school girls is so good, and they tell the truth. It's all very sound racial teaching, but it's done in such a way that I just don't think you can help keep from feeling good about it and approving of it. They did a great job of what it's called propaganda. So you say, oh, they're brainwashing these kids. Well, all kids are brainwashed wherever they are in the world. So it's how you do it. But the way it was done, I thought, was very sensitive and very nice to the kids. And it tries to push them in a certain way, you know, guide and lead them in a certain way. But never at their, I don't think, at their detriment, never to hurt them. I think if a lot of this was exposed in the right way, people would be influenced by it. I was just reading about, eugenics. I think if people would understand eugenics and read about it in its proper way without the hostility toward it, nobody could argue about it. It's so good, you know, it's so good for people. It's so sound. It makes so much sense. And so some of these things, and of course at one time in all these other, all our other white countries, it was being accepted and approved of and putting in, being put in practice. But now it's demonized as, in one instance, they went and took some Negro people and they did some experiments on them that they didn't do on anybody else. You know, always find these particular exceptions that they can make it look bad.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, through your research, what were some of the biggest misconceptions of the Nazis that you discovered? Things that you thought and then later on you're like, oh, no, that's not how it is at all.
I think, you know, the biggest one is the Holocaust, that it for a while I realized that there was a lot of lies about it, but I kept thinking, well, there must be something true about it. I mean, there must be something to it. And that was when I had that epiphany, when I thought, I don't have to believe in that at all. You know, that was part of it. I don't have to keep saying, well, it must be all these people couldn't be lying and there must have been something happening. That was the big bugaboo, I think, because, you know, I remember when that movie, I'm going to start forgetting again, Sophie's Choice came out with that very popular movie actress. And when
Meryl
I went
Streep.
To see that, yeah, Meryl Streep, when I went to see that, I didn't have any doubt that it was all true. You know, I didn't, I never questioned anything like that. And a friend of mine said, surprised me once, a woman I worked with when that in the 70s, when the Holocaust series was on TV, and I wasn't watching it, but some people were talking about it. And she said, well, none of that's true. She said, that didn't happen. It didn't happen. I thought, she nuts? I really liked this woman. I knew she was very intelligent. And I couldn't believe she was saying that. And I said, what are you talking about? Of course it happened. And she said, no, it didn't. And she's gone on. And I don't know what she knew then or how she did. She was Swedish, too. Mm-hmm. Swedish background. But I didn't, I thought, of course it did. So I was, that was a big change for me. But it wasn't hard once I was ready for it, you know, once I get into the whole thing. Now, what else about the that shocked me, I would say nothing, just that my view of Adolf Hitler changed so much because up until after 2004, I had never thought about him or had any idea except that I thought he was funny looking, weird looking. And once I started reading opinions of other people who liked him, I real quickly started changing and opening up to that. And it made me feel good to do so. So,
Well, I think you pick up on the spirit of truth. I feel very strongly about that. You can feel it.
Oh, yes, I do too. And certainly truth for you. I do believe there is truth, because there are some things that happen and some things didn't happen. And, you know, there's no two ways about it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, yeah, I think that when it's true for you, particularly, and see, this was truth for me that I had never, I had just not engaged myself in. And once I did, it just was like a rush, you know. I just loved it. I just kept reading things and so on. So this was truth for me, something that I needed. And I suppose it wouldn't be for everybody. You can't think that that everybody is going to be wants to hear the same things. One thing is that I would like to see. I'm kind of a person that I would like to see everybody think that, you know, not think the same way, but everybody agree, and then we wouldn't have to fight about it anymore. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
And but I have to admit that that might not be such a great world after all. And in any case, it's not going to happen, because there's always people on both sides of everything, and it's just, we have to live with it. And in this case, it's painful to live with. Because of the consequences that are taking place from it. And I don't think we should just live with it. I think we should keep fighting it. But there's always going to be people on two sides of every issue.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I started listening to a lot of Hitler speeches, and I was like, wow, he's speaking out against many of the same things we're talking about, and conspiracy folks are also speaking out against. So I'm surprised that some of these people then turn their back on some of the things that Hitler said and don't even want to look into World War II history, the true side of it, the revisionist side, because he was saying a lot of the same things. He's warning about globalism, he's warning about communism. I mean, everything he said is coming true, too.
He was an extremely intelligent man, and he was kind of a psychic in a way. I don't want to use that word really, but he was sensitive to inspiration and incoming thoughts and ideas that just came, you know, because his mind would be kind of looking for things. He, I guess, a seeker or something. And then that can happen. But he had a lot of experiences of what you'd call inner messages and so on. And from the time he was young, and he listened to them. When he did listen to them, it was amazing. We have some examples of like that. I think it might have been the first time there was an assassination attempt on him. But it was back in the kind of early days, and he was giving a speech in the this place in Munich where they were holding their yearly memorial for the ones that had died in that beer hall putsch. And he was there giving his annual speech. And then he said a voice, something said into him, something said to him, you know, you need to leave. You need to leave right away. You need to leave. And he listened to it. Good for him, you know. And he left. He excused himself and left. And a bomb went off shortly after that, right at the podium where he was speaking. And it killed a number of people, too. That was one set by that George Elsner, whatever. He always got things like that. He was a highly, I would say, evolved human being. And it's interesting because he's portrayed as such a horrible thing.
Oh, yeah. People try and say he was really a closet gay, and he was funded by Jews, and he was in the occult. I've heard it all. It's just like,
those are the things that make me angriest. I hate that stuff. I hate all that occult stuff that they try to pin on him. And I hate, of course, the gay stuff and the Jew stuff. Well, those are the three big ones, I guess, a lot of people will still believe. Well, I think we're reaching people, and I'm not really so negative about it, but I'm not negative about it because you have to think that the truth will eventually prevail, because it seems like it does, although we may be believing big lies from way back in the past, and we don't know that they are. Who knows?
Maybe 100 years from now, Hitler is going to be some other kind of mythological hero. We'll see. Well, you've translated into English the writings of patriotic Germans who were there and give their real life account. What did you discover in some of those writings?
Right. Well, I didn't translate it myself. I don't want to give the wrong impression here, but I did help the German speaker who translated them. And I was not involved in the translation of Willy Wenger's family's, his and his brother's writings, but I did edit all of this stuff. And so I got very involved with it. One of the best pieces are the Anschluss of Austria, it's called on my website, but it's the title of it is actually The Great Hope, the German Reich. And this was written by Willy Wenger, whose brother Leopold was what you could call, I guess, a war hero. He was killed at the very last in April of 1945. You know, on a flight mission, or he had landed. It was crash landing, but he bled to death after he landed because there was nobody around, and he had a wound in his back which he couldn't reach or do anything about. But his younger brother, Willie, was kind of the keeper of all that stuff about his brother and for his brother and for the family. And they were such a great family. They were Austrians, and Willie was just like 10 or so, 9 or 10 went in 1938 when the Anschluss took place. But his brother was Leopold was a little older, and he was in the Hitler Youth, and he was a leader in the Hitler Youth, and he wrote in his diary, he was keeping a diary when he was 14, 15, and it's just amazing how well he did all this, how well he kept account of everything and all the information we'd get from it. And so this story here, though, that Willie wrote about the Anschluss in Austria and how the people reacted and how much they wanted it and how happy they were. There was so much joy all over Austria when that took place. And then it was portrayed as that they were invaded and this was forced upon them, and they were, they suffered and so on. And it wasn't until just recently that finally it's come out, and it's because the Jews don't want to let Austria off the hook that they say, no, they were really collaborating with Hitler all along, and they really wanted it, and they're really Nazis too. Well, they were. But this is a great article. And then in Leopold's articles or his diary, and his letters home all during the war as a pilot. But he also has this thing from, here it's in the first section under Leopold Wenger, Hitler Youth, the days of our revolution. And this is when in his diary, he writes, before it happened, starting on February 12, 1938, and then he's got entries all up until, March. His last entry is in March 20th, when the first German troops arrived. They were waiting for them, and just the excitement, the what he was doing as a Hitler Youth leader, and how intense they felt about all of this. It's one of the best things, I think, if people would haven't read any of this, to read this one, Days of Our Revolution, in the Leopold Wenger section. It shows that these were German, you know, Austrians are Germans, I'm sure you know, and mm-hmm. And they looked to Germany in those years in the 30s when Germany was kept getting better and better under Adolf Hitler, And they wanted to be a part of it, and their own country was held back because they were so small. And they didn't have the kind of industrial base or natural resources or anything, so they remained poor, which is what the others wanted them to be. And so they just yearned to be a part of what was going on in to the north of them. And finally it happened. So and Willie talks, usually mentions, he in a way, I suppose, feels that he has to make some excuses, not to me, but to the people in general, you know, who would see it as wrong, that he talks about that it was based on their idealism. He said, you can see our idealism at this time. And that's really, you know, what the National Socialist experience was all about, I think. It was so idealistic, not in a pie-in-the-sky way, but in a real, with real grit that we're gonna lift ourselves out of this, yep. And we're going to make things better.
And they were prepared to do the hard work and get into it, to do it, to change things. I know. Then comes later the Holocaust of Germans in Dresden, and then, of course, the raping of 2 million German women and some children, but nobody talks about this.
Yeah, they play it down. They don't want it to be known to the extent that it really was. You know, so often these pictures that are shown, a big part of people believing Holocaust is the photographs. Mm-hmm. And they have so many false photographs. They have have photographs of the dead Germans in Dresden, and they label them, you know, Poles who were killed in a camp or something or other, or in the Warsaw Ghetto or something. You can't believe anything. And so here we come to the fact of lying. We were talking about the truth before. But gosh, lies are just... rampant. And you can't talk about this without calling things lies, I think. You have to call it what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was new to me. I didn't learn about Eisenhower's death camps where 500,000 German soldiers died after the surrender. They starved to death. I didn't learn that in school. Did you?
Well, no, they didn't. You know what? I will say when I was in school, none of this was talked about.
Yeah.
Even in high school, I remember in senior, no, that would have been U.S. history. Well, my last world history, well, they had some of that in U.S. history, World War II. Maybe that's why it didn't play a very big role, because that wasn't in my senior year. They just mentioned it kind of, and, you know, of course, it's all pro-U.S. but and pro-allies, but they're not a big deal. No big deal was made out of this stuff. You know why? That tells me that what's made it so nasty has to be the Jewish element, because mm-hmm. the Jews weren't as powerful then, and they weren't running everything in the same way, you know, quite they were in a lot of areas behind the scenes, money and so on, but not they didn't have control of all the media.
Yeah, now we have Jewish intellectuals and universities. We've got Hollywood, right. We've got media, right. we've got it everywhere. So
there's no way not to talk about it. People will say, well, people might be more open to this if it didn't sound like we're blaming the Jews for everything. Well, how do you not talk about the Jews and still talk about it? So
exactly. Yeah, I also heard about some survivor accounts, and I know you've talked about some of this too, where I think it was in the end of Eric Hunt's documentary, there's a survivor talking about, yeah, there's a swimming pool we swam in, and there's a movie and a recreational center and a cafe, and these things were real in the concentration camp. So what did you learn when you were going through some of the survivor accounts?
Well, I authored a little booklet. It's only like 48 pages or something like that. And you can see it on my website, and it's called Auschwitz, the Underground Guided Tour. It came out quite a few years ago, so it's still advertised at Barnes Review in their Holocaust books. You can still buy it. And I have a few copies that I have some extra copies that I would sell if people wanted to buy one for me. But it's pretty much, you know, already past its prime, I guess. But it features my trip to Auschwitz. I went to Auschwitz, and I also visited Dachau and Buchenwald in, I think it was in 2009. And, you know, they, I already knew that it was all a hoax, and so I could make out from that, you know, what was going on. But really, in Auschwitz, they had a lot of nice things, and it really is true, as you say, and people don't want to believe it. And the thing is, people like the story. Unfortunately, people like the story of the horrible, evil Nazis mm-hmm. in their concentration camps and the worst things that they can read about it. They like that, just like people like horror movies and like evil, like to read, you know, nasty stuff. They don't want to learn differently. And they mm-hmm. find it so ludicrous. And, but little by little people realize. But yeah, they, they had, at Buchenwald, even at Buchenwald, they had a kind of a center there with where you could buy food and snacks and you could, I don't know what else they had there. And they did show movies in these camps at times. And at Auschwitz, they even had a theater there in their main place there. They had a small theater. And then just like in the POW camps where the POWs, like the British who were treated pretty well and some French and Italians and so on, they were able to, they were treated quite well, and they could organize entertainment for themselves. And they must have had a budget because they managed to do elaborate things, you know, put on elaborate shows for their own entertainment with costumes and music and so on. And at Auschwitz, there was a theater building, and it was used by the inmates for putting on plays. And they even people from the town could come and see them on certain nights, but they were for all the inmates of the camp. On different nights, different groups would come or something like that, and they had a whole bunch of costumes and musical instruments and all of that. Plus, it's known that they had musical groups. They had choirs. They had, you know, orchestras. They had little smaller music playing groups, and in both camps. And then they explain that by saying, well, they did that to force these poor starving people to use their wonderful creative talents for the benefit of the SS.
Oh, God.
You know, and stuff like that. I mean, that's how they get around it. We just don't have a big enough base to talk about these things, and then we don't get to have the media to counteract all the other side of it, you know, in the media. And that's why our story doesn't get out. But like you say, people like Eric Hunt, he's courageous, and he's also heroic, you know, in trying to get things out that for the more of the masses.
Plus, there's David Cole. David Cole, we've been in touch with him, and he's Jewish, and he went through, which camp did he go through again? Was it Auschwitz, too? Yeah.
Auschwitz, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, David Cole, I don't think you're aware that he's come out with a lot of anti-revisionist stuff since, and he also believes in that 2.5 million Jews were gassed in the Action Reinhardt camps.
When did he come out with this?
Well, you know, He's come back, he's slowly become more and more angry at everybody, and it's been just building up. But he says he always believed this. He said even when he was in the early days before he disappeared, he was talking about Auschwitz. And he understood that what the revisionists had found was true, and he was working along those lines. But he says he still believed in the Holocaust. He still wasn't a Holocaust denier. And he goes on and on like that. Like he never did think that. And but he's taken on David Irving's stance, which I don't know if David Irving is going to actually come through with it for himself or not, because I think he's having trouble finding
maybe
anything.
They got some pressured into it to recant their testimony.
Well, I think David Cole has just reverted. You know, I would not have him on, because he's quite the tricky guy. He's been interviewed by a lot of people who don't know that much about revisionism, mm-hmm. but he is now alienated, and he's insulted and attacked almost every top revisionist that there is, with well-known names except for Germar Rudolph, he sets himself against them. He's arguing, you know, against them, and he's calling them stupid, and this is what's wrong with the revisionist movement. They're all idiots and so on. Only he knows what he's talking about. And I think that during that interim period, I'm not even sure that he was forced out of it. I'm not even sure whether I believe that the JDL attacked him or whatever. But in any case, he went into a new career and a new name. And since he got forced back out of that, he tried to get back into revisionism because he wasn't welcome where he had been. But he's honest enough to say that he wishes he could still be doing what he was doing. He's not happy. And I think that he tried to do it, but he's not been able to do it because he has too many disagreements and he doesn't really like the people anymore. That's what I think. And so it's all falling apart with him and revisionism.
Hey, I was going to say, I was checking out ADL's profile of you.
And you know, they do a good job.
I know. I can go there and find a lot of good guests to interview, actually. So were you banned from Auschwitz? I thought they mentioned something about that.
Banned from Auschwitz?
Yeah, banned from going to check out the camp. Like, you're not allowed to be there anymore because of your underground
No, I don't remember
turbo.
Them saying that.
Okay.
Well, no, I wasn't, of course. I didn't have any problem there. I was very outspoken. I tried to tell the truth. I was not even going to go on a tour, but I met a friend there, and so he wanted to go on. He thought we needed to go on the tour, and he insisted. So, and he was paying for it. So I wanted to get along with him. So I went on the tour. It was terrible, as you can imagine. So I couldn't resist, because I'm just not, wasn't afraid about it at all, to disagree with the tour guide and what she was telling us while we were in these museum buildings, you know, and looking at exhibits and so on. And she says, and some of the people there, they got mad at me. She didn't get mad at me. In fact, one time she said that was a very good question and I was right. And then the people looked at me like, oh, well, you know, these people that go there and take these tours are just that it's like they screw off their brains before they go in there
yeah.
in order so that they will just, you know, take it all, everything just the way. And they think the tour guides are brilliant geniuses and everything they say is true. And they're just sitting there breathless or standing there following along. And they don't want to. They don't want to question anything. Nothing. Although at the end of it, these two people came up to me and said, "Well, you know, I agree with you. I'm disappointed and all this stuff." So I did. Finally, a couple of people got through. Maybe got through to a few more. But you know, it's hard to take what they do there. It's really ridiculous.
It's become a religion. It's not a historical event anymore. But if it is history, it should be subject to the same kind of research and scrutiny as any other past events. So our conceptions of the Holocaust can be subject to critical investigation, but I guess not. That area is off limits, folks.
Well, it is, and it is. It's a sacred thing. The Holocaust victims and survivors are sacred. Even though the survivors are almost all terrible liars, but no, you know, the people believe every word they say too.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is amazing. It says a lot about what the hell is wrong with us. I mean, why do we wake up to these things and most people don't? We talked about that earlier, and those are the only answers I have to it.
So have you had any run-ins or threats by those who want to silence you because you're putting a lot
of
stuff?
No, I only have run-ins and anger from people within our movement, and that's about the about the way it goes, and that's who I find fault with too. Yeah. Mostly, you know, with amongst our own selves, we get critical, and I think I have good reason to. So I find myself arguing with these people, but I don't. I did do a series of. In my Hollow Frauds and Quacks articles, I did some articles, based on what was that, Holocaust Controversies, that real pro-Holocaust website, Joachim Neander wrote some things for them. He's somebody who tries to be, he says he's a professor of some kind, and he tries to be a honest researcher. You know, he defends the Holocaust, but he's open to things. So he's supposed to be somebody who's open to both sides. But I criticize him because I think that he will admit the most ridiculous things, but then he'll try to hold on to all the rest. And so that's the kind of work that he's doing. But when I was writing those things, I've got I wrote on Zizblatt, who is Eric Hunt is connected to her, and it's through Eric Hunt that I discovered her. And I've known Eric Hunt for quite a long time, and we've had our differences, but we go back, and we're good friends right now. I got so interested in that Zizblatt that I wrote a long article about her based on her radio interview and her book and her interview with Spielberg and the whole schmear and so on. It's pretty authoritative, I think. It's pretty good. Anybody wants to know everything about that. But then I got on to what Neander had written about her. And I wrote a critique of that, and then he wrote something back on this Holocaust Controversies, and then I wrote what I call my second response to Jay Neander, and that's on my website. But the Holocaust Controversies people, were calling me names and, you know, all kinds of four-letter word names and so on. And that didn't bother me. And then people in our own movement here, not well-known people, but some kind of, and sometimes just people writing comments, you know, use all those words for me too. So, you know, I've gotten very tough. I know the first time, I'm probably going on too long, but no, I know the first time that I, when I first started getting onto forums and comment sections on the internet, and I tend to speak out quite bluntly. Without, you know, saying, well, I agree with this and that you said, and I do this before I come out with my criticism. But I would say something that was a little bit more than what normally was said there. And then, these men would, maybe one or two of them would come after me like gangbusters.
Yeah,
and I was
amazing.
Shocked, God. You know, and I thought, oh my God. And it affected me. And I thought, What did I do? You know, I thought, I'm never going to say another word, you know, and I thought, and I would not, I'd be sleeping that night, you know, I'd be thinking about it. I felt so bad. And finally it dawned on me, because I then other people would say something nice maybe, but you know, I would realize, I finally learned that there was nothing wrong with me. It was these people that, you know, these were like troll type people, mm-hmm. and they weren't who they said they were. And, so then I got a little tougher, and I got every time I got in trouble from what I said, I would have a reaction to it. It upset me to some degree, and I think, oh, I need to keep quiet. I got to quit. You know, why do I always speak out? And, you know, I got to stop this. But I would do it again the next time, and eventually I just got so used to it. So I don't like it. Who likes it? But some of the things that are said about me, but mostly it's just, you know, certain kind of people that do
you
it.
Seem to have thick skin, right?
Well, I do now, yeah.
So, well, Carolyn, please tell us about your website and how people can find all your work.
Well, like I said, I have three websites people that I maintain that people can go to. My main website is carolynyeager.net, and that's where I have my radio programs also. And I have a website called Ellie Weasel Cons the World, and the URL to that is ellieweaseltattoo.com. I spent a few years working very hard on that, and I have got well over 100 articles all about Ellie Weasel.
I have to interrupt real quick. I have to interrupt real quick. It's funny because his last name is like weasel, like a weasel rat.
Yeah, it really does stand for weasel.
It suits him.
It does. I've not been writing new stuff for that for a while. It's not that I wouldn't if something came up, but he's gotten kind of quiet too. And I've covered just about everything I can think of about him. And I didn't want to just keep concentrating on him. So that's there, and it'll stay there. And then the other one that I have had people helping me with it, but I'm maintaining it, is the January27.org. And I recommend, if people want to get some of the best work done on basic Holocaust revisionism, and it's all focused on Auschwitz, Birkenau there, that they go there and look and read everything that's there, at least a good part of it. You get a real education.
Well, many thanks to you, Caroline, for all your courage, and I hope you continue your work for some time.
Well, thank you, and I certainly hope you do too, and it looks like you will.
I sure will. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye.
I'd encourage you all to investigate Holocaust revisionism further, because there is a plethora of information for those who want to seek the answers. Why does it matter? Because truth matters. In challenging the Holocaust story, we're forced to contend with the entire post-war order which was created by the Allies. The credibility of the victor's version of history is at risk, as the Holocaust is their moral cornerstone of their version of World War II history. So it's no wonder, then, that Western children learn about the Jewish Holocaust ad nauseum, as though it's the only one in history. It's a massive brainwashing operation that starts from a young age. Were you taught about the Russian, Armenian, or Ukrainian Holocaust? What about the one happening right now in Palestine or South Africa? Are these of lesser worth? So think about it the next time you want to yell, Nazi. Because this is the programmed response kicking in from your years of Nazi brainwashing. I used to be there too. You see, this is where most truthers, anarchists, left and right, CNN and Fox, Christian and atheists join as one. On the Nazi issue, it is politically correct to demonize Hitler. I've had a few anarchists write me saying, how can you talk about anarchism and then nationalism? Please listen to the program I did with Craig Fitzgerald, where we spoke about how a nation has nothing to do with government. And well, lately, I have found it fascinating studying Hitler's government structure, because in that era, Germany thrived and its people were blossoming. So what was it? Oh, government is government, Lana. Why waste time? Well, anarchism isn't for everyone. Fascism isn't for everyone, nor communism or nationalism. But I think each one of us is pulled to a different social structure according to what fits us best. Whether you like it or not, you take a side and you are part of a group, and the majority of people will always look to a leader or an elder for wisdom. I think the best thing that could happen to the West is for a splitting off of different political systems, because what we have now is not working. We should be fighting off the one world system and encouraging diversity of politics, and we should be encouraging separation. We make this happen, not the elite. At Red Ice Creations, we're not tied to the one website slogan for the rest of our lives. We're not limiting ourselves to just talking about what's safe and what you want to hear. Clearly, otherwise I wouldn't be talking about Hitler. And we won't do shows about UFOs or 9/11 for 40 years. We're not robots. We're changing and expanding, and we're constantly refining and solidifying our worldview, just as you are. If you recorded yourself for 5 years, wouldn't you look back and cringe at the things you used to say? Radio314.com and RedIceCreations.com are the websites where you'll find our media. You can connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Stitcher, and Radio 314 is still on iTunes. Have a great night.